Julian Oakes is a psychologist who first walked into an investment bank in 1992 to research the dynamics of international groups and the psychology of multinational teams. For her doctorate, she investigated and filmed the life of the trading floor, observing bankers, their thoughts, feelings, and actions. Fascinated by this field, she spent the last 20 years working as an independent psychologist at investment banks in London, Dubai, Mumbai, New York, Singapore, Sydney, and Tokyo. To date, she's worked with over 15,000 bankers in groups and over 700 on a one-to-one basis. Julia, 15,000 bankers in groups and 700 one-to-one. Fundamentally, you're responsible for the financial crisis.
Well, thank you. I'm very flattered that I might have that sort of power. Unfortunately, there are a lot of other factors, as we know only too well.
What was the moment, and can you describe it, when you saw the banking industry and thought, this is a fascinating psychological playground, this is where I'm going to practice?
Okay, so in a very straightforward sense, I went into the banks because I needed access to multinational groups. And the city has, for many, many years, been the most vibrant, exciting place and open in terms of diversity. Every nationality you could hope to encounter was there in the city in the early 90s. So that was very, very exciting for me. I came from a very sort of humanistic background. You know, how do we help countries get along better with one another? You know, probably very naive inquiry, really. However, what I think is important to remember is in the 90s and to some extent most of the 2000s were a period where it was an incredibly entrepreneurial period of banking. So, you know, you'd have concert pianists, you would have a man who had a PhD in chemistry from Cambridge sitting next to a guy that had sold vegetables in Barrow Market. You know, it's a massively, incredibly wonderful sort of enterprising environment. At one point, human resources really didn't have much say in what went on in those days. People were hired in a bar on a Thursday night. They turned up to work on a Friday. It was really quite exciting. I mean, I went to work for Bankers Trust on quite a long project, and the chief exec for Europe at the time said, I don't know what you do, Julia, but whenever you work with teams, they seem to be more effective afterwards. I'm going to give you a job as head of team building. I said, well, what do I do? He said, I don't know. Just get on with it. Here's an office. And that was the mentality.
That mentality has changed fundamentally, has it not? But one question I'd ask, just to go back a little bit. You've worked in all these countries with all these different cultures, and you're, from a humanist point of view, wanting to understand what drives conflict and try to quell that, if you like. What is the one trait amongst all the bankers, creative or not, what is the one trait that you would say unifies that tribe of people?
Very interesting question. An incredible drive, I would say, is probably the thread that runs through all of that. Now, where that drive comes from, I think, can vary. So, you know, if you go back to the there was less drive in the era of the bowler hat phase of banking, but I think you have people from all kinds of backgrounds, whether they were in Tokyo or whether they were in New York or whether they were in London, who were quite driven by a need to excel. Now, in my experience, certainly with some of the post-colonial countries like India, you have a lot of people who, in a sense, have grown up in families that are quite traumatized. And one way of dealing with trauma is not to go and see someone like me. It's to not need anybody, to prove that you're bulletproof, you're a warrior, you don't need anyone. And a warrior always has to be on top of everyone else.
So the warrior spirit and this absolute drive are the two things that are universal in that culture?
I think they're certainly universal in that culture pre-credit crunch.
Because at a kind of reductionist level, people would look at that and go, huge amount of drive and a warrior spirit, that person's going to be successful. Post-credit crunch, we're now beginning to redefine success. And one of the things that we're seeing increasingly is corporate disillusionment. And the glory days of banking have gone, pretty much, and the entrepreneurs certainly don't want to go into the banks for lots of reasons. Can you just talk a little bit about this? And then how does that leave those people who have got the incredible drive and have got that warrior spirit? Where are they now?
Well, where a lot of the entrepreneurs of the pre-credit crunch days in banking are, is a lot of them are sitting around in the banks doing very little, and they're running a lot of very interesting businesses outside of it. So you may find one of those high energy, driven, ambitious bankers, if they're still in a bank, you can guarantee they're probably investing in at least 5 to 10 startups. They in imaginative companies that they'd really like to be a part of. And remember, the entrepreneur that's in a bank knows that he didn't quite have the courage to be an entrepreneur outside of the bank. So he likes to be around people that had the courage.
I always hear from bankers at dinner parties, when I have my second career, I'm going to give back. And my immediate response is, what have you taken? Right. So there's a schizophrenia between who they are and what they do. As a psychologist, you must, as a working surface, that must come up a lot in your work when you're working with these people. Can you talk a bit about that?
You're describing, in a sense, a kind of splitting. You know, there's this, I'm going to be this person for a while, and then I'm going to be this other person later. Now, this is one of the biggest and saddest illusions in life, that somehow you can disassociate, disconnect from yourself and bury yourself in the corporate world within that sort of red brick mother of the corporation. And somehow this pure, innocent, amazing man is going to emerge when he retires. He doesn't. It's an illusion. It's using language to comfort and soothe that deep down I am really that interesting entrepreneur. I mean, Jekyll and Hyde is the extreme version of the splitting, isn't it? You know, this man has his head down, does all the right things during the day, and at night he turns into this other character. So, I mean, you have a lot of characters like that in banking, in the sense that the corporate performance of having to use fakery, having to perform, having to act in certain ways, pretend something doesn't matter when it does, is going on all the time. Now, that splitting is, you know, it is classic corporate man behavior. Now, corporate man is dangerous from a moral sense, because he really does believe that he can be a good man in the evening. You know, one of the characteristics I would say that bankers today talk to me most about is their bosses. They haven't got a clue who they are. They haven't got a clue what they stand for. They haven't got a clue what they believe in, because all they see is corporate man.
So the way bankers are depicted in the media, which is, and you know, people love to hate them, and that's not a view that we take, because I think as soon as you brand something, you lose the ability to really define it. You know, bankers and that broad brush, you can't tar everyone with the same brush. But the picture that you've painted is so fundamentally bleak, because there is this divide between who they are and who they think they are. You must be incredibly busy trying to heal that disconnect, or at least make them aware of it. Seems to me that whatever bonus round or whatever's driving them onto the next pay packet is actually exacerbating the problem.
What I think is interesting, and this isn't just about banking, this is about the nature of the employee psychology. So the employee psychology is very much the need to be psychologically contained by an institution. So I call that the red brick mother. Often you find people who are less likely to be entrepreneurs, who are more likely to be employees in a big system, have had, in a sense, perhaps not the most straightforward of mothering when they were growing up. They sometimes, you know, typically an institutionalized child, for example, boarding school, he's contained within the boarding school environment. There are rules, there are procedures, there is structure. The structure contains psychological anxiety. So what you find is the boarding school majority will go into the army, the police, banks. Sartre wrote a wonderful piece about a husband who goes to work, and the wife spends all day crying alone at the window. And immediately one thinks, well, oh, poor woman, you know, she must be so missing her husband. But it's the sheer terror of the freedom. And that's the illusion that I think I'm getting at with that employee psychology. Now, the other thing to bear in mind is it was very fashionable in the 90s and the early 2000s to be a banker. It was cool.
But what you have, if you like, with the bankers, is they have all these startups quietly under the radar. They're keeping face and doing their day job. And you've got that huge disconnect. Where does that leave? You can't have that split focus if you're running a business. Where does that leave this whole industry? Because it seems to me it's rats leaving a ship.
Well, I think bankers themselves today, if you were to interview five MDs today, I think possibly what they would say would be, we're really trying to make sense of our role in this new bureaucratized world of finance. You know, on some level, is could the banks be run without people? Could computers run the banks? So I think there is a real questioning of what is, we know that the world wants banks to be more predictable, more stable. They don't want it to be entrepreneurial. It's too risky, it's too dangerous. So there is a sense where a lot of people are keeping their heads down. They're not doing the interesting things that they might have done before. Mm-hmm. So if you're keeping your head down at work, well, maybe do something else with your time while you're there. Think about other things. I certainly believe that the entrepreneurial era, when a barrow boy could sit next to the PhD guy, when you'd have concert pianists that would become a sales guy, you had this wonderful, incredible diversity. It's completely changed the world. It's gone into another level of bureaucracy and corporatizing and MBAs, and it's just not as interesting for many people.
Should banking have a social purpose?
Big question. Big question. Should banking have a social purpose? Well, I'm going to start with a story. There are a lot of incredible bankers that I certainly know who use the majority of what they earn for social purposes. So an amazing network of bankers that I know in who have done incredible things for the environment, for forest, for animal welfare, for wildlife and things and so on. Whether banks can do something in terms of a social purpose within capitalism, I find quite difficult to figure out how that could ever possibly work when you think about it, capitalism fundamentally rests on exploiting people. So I can't see how that could ever work in terms of a social purpose. There are always moral choices, however. So, you know, a leading group of people within a bank can make decisions to not do things. However, they have shareholders that say, why aren't you making as much money as this other bank? So I think I'm probably more interested in questioning capitalism itself.
Do you think the days of maximizing shareholder value have finally got to a point where we've, as a silent majority, begun to question that mantra?
I don't think we're questioning that enough. I really don't understand why people aren't more outraged at increasing the shareholder value. The outrage I feel towards bankers and their pay was really a lot more to do with the outrage of the ordinary working person's pay. You know, we don't care if a pop star or a footballer earns multi-millions, but somehow there was something about banks and finance that we found distasteful. And they're all symptoms, I think. They're symptoms of a system that doesn't fundamentally work.
It's incredible. Also back to my dinner party. One thing happens a lot at about 10:30 if it's in a weeknight. The banker around the table will always say, "I've got to go. I've got to be up at 5 a.m. tomorrow morning." Right? And I've never been at a dinner party at a farmer's house where he's ever said to me, "I've got to go. I've got to be up at 5 a.m. tomorrow morning." And it's almost worn as a badge of honour, this FaceTime and long hours thing and being seen in the office and all the rest of it. Is that a cover? Because why that boast?
I think we glorify busy. If you're busy, it means you're important. Now, maybe you're important anyway, whatever you do, whether you get up at 10 or whatever. But I do think busyness is one of the gods that the city worships. Now, one of the best leaders I've worked with, who had a background in rugby, he was a rugby coach and was in the England youth rugby. He would leave the trading floor at 5 o'clock. He was a global head of one of the businesses. He'd look at guys and say, "I'm going home because I'm not as disorganized as you."
To finish on a positive note, and so we can inspire and be a little more solutions-driven, because we can always smash this up. What our conversation so far has been fundamentally male-orientated. During the 08 crisis, and if we look at countries, Iceland, the women investing in a fund there didn't lose a penny. Now, this brings us to a thorny debate, which we're not going to have today, about, you know, who are the better traders and who are the better business people. And one of the women whose name is incredibly difficult to pronounce, but I think it's Tramistador, Hella Tramistador, said that they took over in Iceland because it goes back to the Viking days. Whilst the men were out raping and pillaging, they were at home looking after the place. So let's talk about the rise of empathy and the rise of the feminine. Because from an entrepreneurial point of view, if I go out into the world now and ask a team just to follow me because I've got a plan, forget it. Well, I can get some people to do that, but not the talent. So what we have now is the rise of nurture. I saw a book called The Athena Doctrine. The tagline to the book is how women and men who think like them will rule the future. So let's just talk about the rise of the feminine and those traits, as opposed to this, you know, warrior, all that hard language, that muscular language that we've used, warrior, drive, discipline, you know, all that stuff. What's your view on this, and is that actually, from a leadership point of view, starting to push away from the narcissism and all those negative traits that we've covered?
Okay, I'm going to mention some research that was done at Harvard by a man called Bill Torbert, and he developed something called the Leadership Maturity Profile. It's a challenging instrument. It asks you lots of questions, open-ended questions. And the bottom line is the higher levels of leadership he found predominantly in women rather than in men. Now, this, I think, is really about more balance between the masculine and feminine. So in the sort of period of MBAs, corporate bureaucracy in banking, we had, you know, this huge drive. I'm talking around the late 90s, early 2000s. To have more women in banking. Now, the problem with that is wearing a skirt doesn't make you female. So you can have women who are very masculine. You can also have men who have a really great female qualities. I wrote an article for The Times, which they commissioned, which was, would the credit crunch have happened if there had been more women? And I said yes, that it was about wider system issues. But I do think the problem for women in the city still is that the feminine gets expelled and women tend to represent that. So, however, again, some of the best leaders I've worked with have a balance between that sort of warriorness. They have decisiveness. They know what they think. They know where their boundaries of right and wrong. They also know, and they have the sort of confidence that narcissistic people tend not to have, to be able to listen to another point of view, to really hear what somebody has to say. My concern is that we are likely to have less and less of those people in the city.
Why?
Because of the nature of the structure of very large organisations. They're less appealing to those people. They want to work for themselves.
IBM recently ran a study asking 1,800 CEOs globally what are the two most important leadership traits that they're going to need for the next business cycle. And the two were creativity and adaptability. And I'd like to add one more to that, which is emotional intelligence. And not just because you can read Dan Goldman's book and then say you're emotionally intelligent, actually genuinely practicing it. And then they said, yeah, but what's your business challenge? They said, well, our biggest challenge from these 1,800 CEOs is that we strip adaptability and creativity out of all our people by the time they've got to the top. So this brings us to the arts. Because you mentioned that in back in the day, there was a concert pianist sitting in a bank as a sales guy. Well, could it not be the case that actually finance now needs to find its creative purpose? And actually it needs to go and start speaking to the arts as opposed to just throwing it a bit of cash now and then and saying, what can we learn from you?
Yes, I agree. And I think the banks are very scared about doing that. They're saying, you know, every time we do creative things and they go wrong, we are lambasted in the press. We are hated. So we're not going to do anything creative.
So that fear of failure, it's just cowardice, frankly. I mean, so what? You just don't fail at all and you keep up appearances. The fail fast, surely, it should be a mantra.
I spoke to two bankers yesterday, and these are guys I admire. I asked them, what did they think was the biggest challenge in the city at the moment? And they both said, indecisiveness. There's a lot of fear about making decisions. Whereas I think pre-credit crunch, there was a rather ruthless nature to making decisions. So you have a lot of fear. I would say the levels of fear in banking right now are higher than I've ever known them. So typically a banker will say to me, I wake up feeling afraid. That's very, very common. To literally wake up feeling afraid. And they will say things like, at best, I feel a low level of anxiety all day. At worst, I'm terrified I'll get fired. Now, for some of us, getting fired wouldn't terrify us because we don't have that employee mentality. But again, like the woman when she's left behind with her husband, it's a lot of fear. Now, okay, so there's a form of psychotherapy which is called Gestalt psychotherapy. Its roots are in psychoanalysis. We believe that there is the unconscious. We are all unknowable to ourselves and each other. And our best way to live in the world is creatively and to experiment. Now, when people have a very tight employee profile, they're very scared of the future without that structure. So I will say, let's do an experiment. So there's an emphasis, a bit like Gandhi, on an experiment. So I might say something, okay, spend all day Friday, do an experiment on gratitude. Tell people how fabulous they are. Just see what happens. Try it out like you're trying on a coat. See what happens. Spend a whole day without a plan, walking around a city. See what happens. Now, you can manage a day, but 2 days, you know, saying you're going to manage a whole life is another thing. So what I love and have always loved about bankers is that when you get them on board, they will really play, because these are very, very smart people. If you can give them a good idea why they should do something, they will try all sorts of things. So I'll give you an example. Two clients I saw in the same day. In the morning, I saw a vice chancellor of a university. He wanted to work with me to get his vision for the university fixed by the end of the year. I saw a banker in the afternoon. He wanted to get his vision for his business sorted out by the end of our meeting. Yeah, whole different approach to time.
It's this amazing thing, isn't it? Because the creative process is the creative process. I know that sounds glib, but you have to walk through it and you have to be at ease with your uneasiness, because there are moments where you think, God, I'm terrible, the world's terrible, this is terrible, the idea's not working. And then out of the, you know, visit to death, as they call it in Hollywood script writing terms, or the dark night of the soul, suddenly something comes. But it seems that crippling fear that exists now, I wouldn't just say in banks, across the corporate culture, means that no one takes risks, therefore we've got this frozen conflict. And again, it comes back to the arts. Could that creative lick start to thaw that? That's it. And I'd be interested to see what you think.
Well, I think when you're talking about the arts joining more closely with corporations, I think to some degree that's happening. However, what I think is happening is the arts are becoming more like corporations. So I worked before Christmas, I recently worked with one of our leading London galleries, and they are trying to bureaucratize themselves with procedures, with performance management processes. And what's happening is all the young talent, the interesting talent, is thinking about leaving. So there seems to be influence going in one direction, but not in the other.
The whole of this country has become one big lunatic asylum, with this silo mentality of trying to split things up, rationalise and control.
Absolutely. And part of it happens, I think, because if you look at the mid-90s, the reason the banks became so bureaucratised was because for every 100 jobs, 6,000 people applied. How were you going to differentiate between those people? So the American influence that was around the banks at the time, suddenly the MBA. The MBA. The tragedy of the MBA and what that did to people.
There's some people say the acronym is actually maybe best avoided. Would you subscribe?
Absolutely, absolutely. Because I think the MBA actually kills people's spirits with procedures and rules and governance.
You use the word yoke. Did you think that? Do you think it just weighs people down? And actually says to them, can you park your intuition and common sense at the door?
Absolutely. I absolutely agree. Absolutely agree. So you would. It went. Things shifted in banking from a wonderful guy who is a great entrepreneur, fantastic trader, who got a job in the city by leaving a note on every Porsche he could find in the city saying, "I'm talented. I'm 17. I'm not qualified in anything. Give me a job." In the city back then, he could get a job, and he had this great common sense. One day, a group of traders are all falling out, not talking to each other. He goes out, buys six babies dummies and said, "Here you go, take these guys." So there was a sort of rhythm of humanity that these guys brought in. People cannot get into banking with that rhythm of humanity and that entrepreneurship because they just would never get in.
Will the entrepreneurs then, so what's the next wave? Where's the next creative, where's the next bit of creative destruction, and where's the next piece of innovation going to come from? Because we've heard tech like a mantra. But actually, tech is the medium, you know, not the message. So where now? Because there's, for the entrepreneur that unlocks that, the gains are significant.
Well, you take a company that's very successful now called Entrepreneurs First. They go to Cambridge at graduate time. It was started by a couple of young people, I think, from McKinsey's. And they will say, come and be with us. We will give you an 8-week training in how to be an entrepreneur. And we will try, and you will work together in this room, and you'll come up with ideas for businesses. And we will help you find backers. And this is because this kind of thing is becoming much more popular than, please, would you like to come and join Citigroup? I mean, who wants an umbrella, really, on their business card, I say.
Julia, I'm sure this is not the last time we will speak. Julia Noakes, psychologist and author of Bankers on the Couch. Thank you very much for your time.
Pleasure.